Don't cry, little one, don't cry, little one. The bear is coming to dance for you. The bear is coming to dance for you. That is a Mohawk Indian cradle song, crooned to children. It is also a shamanic power song from one of the first peoples of North America. It invites the protection and the alliance with the great medicine animal of North America, the bear. If you're going to do healing amongst traditional Native Americans, you want the bear spirit, the bear energy on your side. I discovered some things about the bear in my dreaming when I first started living in North America. Before I'd come to North America, the bear was a cuddly, cute animal who lived with me on my pillow in the form of a teddy when I was a kid, or whom I visited in zoos. When I came to North America, it became a bit different, and I began to understand what power animals or animal guardians mean to traditional shamanic peoples, and how they walk through the night forests of our own dreams, even if we've never heard of shamans or their ways of doing things. So let me introduce the theme of dream relationships with allies or protectors who appear in animal forms by talking a little bit about my dreams of the bear since I came to North America. One of the dreams that was a turning point in my life was one in which a huge standing bear, a grizzly I think, walked into my dreams and invited me into his embrace. I was a little bit nervous. You might be too. Here is a creature bigger than you, covered with hair, with immense curving claws, inviting you to cuddle with it. Well, I braved up. And when I stepped into the embrace of the bear in my dream, I found that he wanted me to dance with him. And we danced a circle dance, a pretty heavy, clumsy circle dance. American Indians say that you can hear the footprints of the bear. So we're doing this great shambling, bear-like circle dance. And the bear is pointing something out to me, and I look at my chest, and I notice that there is a cord, as physical, as tangible as an umbilical cord, that joins my heart to the heart of the bear. When I see this cord in my dream, I understand that I have a deeper connection with a spiritual energy that shows itself in the form of this great medicine animal than I had previously considered possible. The bear in my dream shows me something else. He shows me that he can somehow unzip his skin, and he wants to give it to me, and he wants me to take off my skin and trade it with him. So in the circle dance, I am now dancing in the skin of the bear, and he is dancing in my skin. And the bear tells me, because he has the power of speech, perhaps it's telepathic communication, but it comes in the semblance of human speech. He tells me to burn sage for him, and he tells me to call him when I need to bring together a healing circle. That is one of the dreams that prepared me for my practice as a shamanic dreamer. I wish a dream like that for you, a dream in which you will discover a part of your power, a part of your soul identity, a part of your natural ability to heal yourself and to help to heal others. I wish you a dream messenger, a dream ally, as strong and as reliable as the bear has proved for me. He still walks through my dreams. He still dances in some of my gatherings. He walks through the pages of my books, including a recent novel, The Interpreter, in which he is the great power animal who brings healing and insight. None of this, interestingly enough, is in any way strange or exotic in the lives of contemporary dreamers. However city-bound we may be, even if we rarely see a wild animal larger than a squirrel or a rabbit or the occasional white-tailed deer nibbling at suburban lawns, we know the powers of the wild in our dreams. In fact, wild animals and birds come into the dreams of modern dreamers to call them to a deeper life. This can be a thrilling encounter, a thrilling summons. Let me tell you a couple of stories about this from dreamers who have shared their dreams with me. A woman in her dreams is in a safe space, which resembles a room in her house that is her safe space at home, her sewing room. She likes to sew. She's good at it. She produces beautiful fabrics, clothes, drapes. And it's something she can do to get away from the clutter of her life. It's a centering thing. So in her dream, she's in the safe, familiar space, working at the sewing machine. And she feels a little ripple of excitement, a little shiver running up and down her spine, pricking at the back of her neck, and turns around to see an enigmatic figure standing behind her and looking at her. He looks like a Native American man with long black hair, aquiline features. He is absolutely silent. He just looks at her intently as he stands behind her, as if there is something she needs to discover, but she won't get it by just receiving it on a plate. She looks him over. He's a fine-looking man, but there is something strange about him at the level of the solar plexus. At the level of his navel, there is a hole in his body, a great chasm in his body. And inside this cavernous space in the dream visitor's body is a large black raven, purple gloss on its plumage, looking at her out of his sharp black eyes. She feels a tremendous thrill of excitement, tinged with fear. The fear finally brings her out of the dream, but she wants to go back to it because she feels that a message has come to her. Now, once you start paying attention to dreams, you'll find that they spill over in interesting ways into the patterns of your waking life, or perhaps it's simply that once you become attentive to dreams, you notice the hidden order, the hidden logic of everyday life, deeper patterns. So I'm walking with this dreamer who has just shared the dream at a dream workshop along a street in Santa Fe where neither of us has ever been before, and she suddenly freezes outside the window of an art gallery, and I turn to see what has caught her with such shock and excitement. And there in the window of the art gallery is a clay figure of a Native American with a hollow at the solar plexus and a bird sitting inside the hollow. The bird in the waking encounter is not a raven, but the resemblance to the dream is so strong, and we've just been working with the dream, that she now knows she has to go back to this dream and discover its deeper meaning for her life. She does some research. She journeys on it. She makes a conscious dream journey through the gate of her remembered dream, as you have been learning to do, and she discovers a teacher. The Native American turns out to have a tribal identity and a personal name, or a dream name. He turns out to be a Menominee shaman of long ago, one of whose power allies is the raven. He has a tricksterish side, which finally leads the dreamer to feel, after some experiments, that he won't be an enduring ally for her, but in the process of working with him, talking to him, she discovers healing procedures, divinatory techniques, and writes down some wonderful, wonderful, hauntingly beautiful poetry, delivered by him in the chanting voice of someone singing his power song. Isn't this rather exciting? What is reflected in this story? Actually, a couple of things reflected in that story. First, that dream visitors appear to contemporary dreamers, not connected with traditional shamanism or with any spiritual practice that involves consulting or working with animal powers. They appear in the form of animals in our dreams. Secondly, that the spirits of the earth itself are likely to speak to us if we pay attention, and they will speak to us and try to get through to us in some way, even if we don't. As a matter of fact, from a shamanic point of view, there are two kinds of spirits in life you can never get away from, even if you're embarrassed by talk of spirits and prefer to use other language, like Jung, who, living in Zurich, city of bourgeois bankers and cuckoo clocks, talked about archetypes of the collective unconscious instead of spirits. There are, I repeat, to use simple language, clear language, two kinds of spirits from a shamanic perspective that you're unlikely to be able to get away from in life. You'll have to deal with them some way or another, and they will reach to your consciousness in dreams. The first are the spirits of the land where you live, including the spirits of other species, nature spirits, presences of the earth itself, spirits of the first peoples of the land where you live, spirits of generations of people who are buried or cremated or died on the land you inhabit. When I moved to North America, I started dreaming of the bear, and I started dreaming of Iroquois shamans of long ago who required me to learn enough of their own language to enter their mindset and work with their technical vocabulary. Sometimes these encounters require you to stretch your existing understanding. The second kind of spirits that you're going to have to deal with in life from a shamanic point of view are the spirits of your own ancestors. Recently departed members of your family, members of your family in earlier generations, and maybe all the way back to that primal ancestor in Africa or Atlantis or Alpha Centauri or wherever you find that you come from. But let us stay with the theme of the animal ally or teacher or guardian figure who might appear in your dreams. Another dreamer, a male dreamer, a man who had been living a rather left-brain life and had some difficulty with sharing inner experiences, came to me with a fascinating dream. He perceived it as a calling, but was uncertain about its exact meaning, wanted clarification. Let me share this dream with you that he shared with me. In his dream, he is very nervous about following a trail through the jungle. He's going through a primal environment, scary to him as a man used to carefully trimmed lawns and picket fences. He's being pulled or pushed along a forest trail in his dream, and he's going unwillingly. The being that is pushing him down the forest trail is a Bengal tiger, beautiful and savage, awesome in tooth and claw. And it is butting him and nudging him and nipping him lightly, its claws largely velveted, to shunt him down this forest trail. And he's scared, but he doesn't know how to get away from the tiger. The tiger will not get off his case. The tiger pushes him, shunts him, butts him all the way down the trail until he comes out in a clearing where the reason for this journey is revealed to him. He has made this involuntary journey in his dream in order to come out at a place of training. The nature of the training is quite fascinating in this modern American man's dream. He is to be trained as a jet pilot. He is to learn to fly the most up-to-date modern fighter planes. And in the next part of the dream, he proceeds to do this with great technical proficiency. He is thrilled to discover his unsuspected ability to dive and soar and fight in a plane, on a different plane of reality. And he's put through some training exercises, and he gets involved in a dogfight. And in the course of the dogfight, he learns something else. He learns to use discrimination. He realizes he actually doesn't want to shoot and kill people. He wants to use his power in a gentle way to protect those he is meant to protect. And so instead of shooting down other planes that seem to be hostile, he forces them to land so he can check on the nature and identity of the occupants. The story goes on a bit further, but that's enough to convey its power and its gift to you. What is going on here? Once again, we see a dream visitor in the form of an animal, a powerful animal, savage, primal, predatory, who could have been fled from, as we typically flee from nightmare adversaries. But because the dreamer stuck with the dream or was forced to stay with the dream, he came to this thrilling experience of being trained in a whole new dimension of ability and proficiency. He becomes a pilot. He becomes familiar with flight. He learns that he has a power to protect and to guard those who need to be protected and guarded. When he came to me with this dream, he said, "What am I supposed to do with it?" I said to him, "You are meant to earn your pilot's wings in waking life," by which I didn't mean that he should join the U.S. Air Force. I meant he is meant to be trained as a shamanic dreamer who can use the power of dream flight and dream travel to protect and guard others, which is what he has proceeded to do. He has shown in his shamanic training as a conscious dreamer the same facility that he discovered in his dream, in which he becomes a jet pilot, has become quite good at helping to protect those who need protection on the planes that are invisible from ordinary sight. So those two stories of the woman who discovers the raven shaman, of a man who is led to his own deeper vocation by a Bengal tiger, are tales really not at all unusual of how dream messengers and dream allies show themselves to us in the midst of our ordinary lives in the guise of animals, birds, whales, dolphins, fish, creatures of the wild. The traditional shamanic understanding of the relationships that might emerge in this way is quite interesting. Shamans, by definition, work with the animal powers. If we need a larger definition of shamanism, we might say it is a technique for shifting consciousness to embark on conscious dream journeys. In other words, it includes much of what we've been exploring in previous sessions. But shamans have some other particular characteristics. One is that their province is the soul. We have bodies, we have souls, we have enduring spirits. To give a very simple tripartite definition of human identity. The particular province of the shaman is the province of soul, that which feeds our embodied life, or fails to feed it. From a shamanic point of view, the relationship with animal allies, or allies that show themselves in animal forms, is a vital part of living. We're fully embodied, with full access to our natural soul energy. From a traditional shamanic viewpoint, if you are lacking a relationship with allies of this kind, who are not necessarily confined to showing themselves in animal or bird forms, you might be missing a vital part of your soul energy that you need to reclaim. For shamanic dreamers, the relationship with the power animal or animal guardian has other aspects. It is part of the process of dream travel by shape-shifting in the dream body into the form of an animal or bird familiar. The shaman promotes and accelerates his or her ability to travel beyond the body and beyond the limits of space-time, to do work of healing, divination, or soul retrieval, or guidance of the souls of the departed that might be required. This is the truth of shapeshifting. You go through the folklore, you go through the oral memory of some indigenous peoples, and you'll find stories of shamans who physically became the tiger, or whatever it was. But shapeshifting as we know it today is essentially about your ability, in the dream body, to change form. It's a very quick way and a very effective way to embark on a conscious dream journey, to fold time and space, to bring gifts of healing and insight to others. Sometimes the animals we meet in dreams, the wild animals, evoke aspects of ourselves, of our natural identity, even our physical body type or style. And it's fun to work with these connections. A woman dreams that she returns to her house in literal reality, and there is a lioness sleeping by her front door. And she wakes up inside the dream to the fact that the side of her that is the lioness has been sleeping, has been dormant in her life, and it might be time to allow her lioness to awaken. Another dreamer discovers a wolf that is starving in her backyard. It absolutely has to be fed. And in that dream discovers an aspect of herself personified as the grey wolf that she needs to feed. How? She dreams on that too and discovers a whole path she needs to follow, which includes physical exercise, running as the wolf, changing some of her dietary habits to feed the animal part of her that needs some of the things that the wolf eats, changing her style to claim her power, walk more strongly, learn to discriminate who belongs to the herd and who does not. So one of the fascinating things about dreams of animals is this discovery we can make all the time about some aspects of our natural identity and energy that we might not have honored or recognized clearly in the patterns of our waking lives. An interesting question that opens up is, how does this relate to our connections with animals that we know who can live with us in the house? It's unusual for most of us to have wild animals living on our premises, although there are people living close to nature who feed bears, who feed wolves, who protect wildlife, and have a natural everyday relationship with wild animals. This is not typical of most people who live in urban or suburban environments today. I think, as I embark upon this theme, of a woman in Texas whose friend looks after wild cats who have been injured. He's fed and sustained bobcats, and even the occasional young cougar who has turned up, injured or ill or lost in some way. She told me a story of an encounter with a cougar in his home. It was a young cougar, and she'd been invited to a dinner party, and the cougar was ranging the house with the same freedom that you would allow your domestic tabby cat. Her friend had gone into another room. Other people were occupied in conversation. None of them noticed when the cougar jumped up into the woman's lap and clamped his jaws around her windpipe. At which point she found herself starting to suffocate. She couldn't breathe. She was terrified. She didn't know what to do. She didn't dare to move. She could not speak. She has the cougar's jaws clamped around her windpipe, closing off her breath and her speech. Fortunately, her friend returns from the kitchen, sees what is going on, and removes the cougar from her throat. She asked me, "What do you think was going on here?" I said to her, "Well, if it were my life, if it were my encounter with a cougar, I would probably say to myself that I can think of only two reasons why a cougar would jump up and clamp his jaws around my windpipe. The first would be that he sees me as food, but that can't be so in this case because he didn't break the skin. He didn't rip my throat out. Big cats kill their prey typically by shutting off their breath, either by ripping out the throat or by clamping the jaws over the nose and mouth. So the cougar doesn't actually seem to regard me as food because he didn't break the skin. The only other reason I can think of why the cougar would do this is that he's going through that playful stage of training for being the hunter and predator and warrior. But we notice even in our domestic cats, he's clamping his jaws around my windpipe, if it's my experience, because he recognizes me as one of his own. He regards me as a fellow cat or fellow cougar. He's treating me exactly the way he would treat his sister or his brother. In those playful frolics in which cats of all kinds learn to hunt, learn to kill, practice. They don't actually hurt each other. He probably didn't realize that he might have hurt me, if it's my experience, because I'm not in a cougar's body. She was so electrified by this experience that she decided to make a conscious dream journey on it, discovered the cougar as a personal ally, and since she brought her cougar side back, has had to have the lenses of her glasses changed because she sees better than before and has a degree of night vision she didn't consider possible before she found her cougar. Let me pursue the theme of how this relates to our relationship with our domestic animals, animals who regularly live in the house. There is no cat that I know that regards itself as a tame animal or as belonging to a human. The cats that I know are either simply independent and self-willed or believe that their humans exist to support and protect and provide for them. Cats, by my observation, are wild, even if they live under our roof and velvet their claws. So our relationships with cats, cats that we feed and support, are relationships with allies, just as dream relationships with wild animals are relationships with animal powers, animal guardians. Dogs, I love dogs and cats. I have not divided, but multiple loyalties in relation to the animal kingdoms. Dogs are guides of the soul in many traditions, and isn't that appropriate when you think about it? Because dogs, although domesticated wolves, I suppose, if you go back to the origins, dogs are friends of humankind, companions of humankind, supporters of humankind. And so there's a reason why in one mythology after another you see a dog, often a black dog, interestingly enough, at the side of the psychopompus, the psychopomp, the guide of souls, as he or she travels between the world. You might see a more ferocious dog as guardian of the portal between this world and the other world, a dog like Cerberus with his three heads. You might think of the jackal, but also dog-like figure of Anubis, as conductor, escorter of the souls of the departed in ancient Egypt. You might think of the black dog in other traditions. You might think of the dog of Mithras in the Mithraic Mysteries. Hermes sometimes has a dog as an escort, the great psychopompus, the great psychopomp of Greek tradition. And in our dreams, it's interesting, dogs often play the role of showing us a path or a passage between the worlds so we might not have noticed without them. I find working with elderly people who are preparing for the great journey that follows physical death that encouraging them to remember favorite dogs who died and encouraging them to work with dreams that come spontaneously of favorite dogs who have passed away is excellent, loving, beautiful, spirited soul work. I remember in my own life the teaching that a dog I loved tremendously brought to me when I saw him after his death, after he'd been killed in an accident on the road. Hunting and frolicking and sporting as he had done in life on an island across the river, he raised his head when I called to him, and then I noticed an invisible screen, almost like shrink wrap, that sort of quality, that covered the scene, covered the island, so he couldn't see me, but he could hear me. And despite that separation in the dream, he came to me and to others several occasions after that, in the role of protector, guide, companion. So when we think about relationships with power animals or animal guardians, we must not exclude the domestic animals that are familiar to us, that we love, with whom we have a deep emotional relationship. These too are friends and allies and companions in dreaming as they are in physical life. You might be thinking at this point, how far does this extend? If I can have an alliance, a soul relationship with a dog or a tiger or an elephant or a dolphin or a blowfish or an eagle or a sandhill crane, can I also have a comparable relationship with other species, with snakes, with insects, with machines? If in the shaman's world, as in dreaming, everything is alive, why shouldn't these relationships extend across the waterfront? Perhaps they do. I'm not personally very enthusiastic about regarding most insects as power animals, but I don't rule it out. I had a teaching about that in one of my own dreams, when a swarm of bees appeared in my dream and arrayed themselves around the contours of my body, filling in my energy field, so to speak, so that I was surrounded by a living swarm of bees. And in my dream, they gave me an instant ability to fly beyond my physical body, and I flew with them, the bees still defining the outline, the contours of the dream body that was traveling. And they conducted me, sudden as thought, but with multisensory, vivid, tactile impressions, to a scene of mystery initiation in Greece in which I seemed to attend the epopteia, the climactic moment of the Greek mysteries. I noticed after that in some of my studies that there was a court case, or the equivalent of a trial, in ancient Greece. This is reported by the rhetorician Sopatros, for those of you who want to check the sources. There's an account of a trial held in ancient Greece of a man who was accused of blasphemy or worse for revealing the awesome secrets of the Greek mysteries. And in court, he related how he had dreamed the whole process. And he was held innocent because it was ruled that he had been initiated in his dream, so he had not been initiated in his physical body. He had been through the whole ritual of mystery initiation in a dream. And he is considered, therefore, to be an initiate and authorized to know and relate to other initiates what he knew. In my dream, it seemed to me, I don't want to sound ego-inflated about this, it seemed to me that bees had been my escort in conducting me to a scene of mystery and initiation in ancient Greece that showed me from the inside, it seemed, a possible version of what happened, which has been a subject of endless speculation for scholars, but can never be retrieved from documents or inscriptions, because the heart of these things is secret and is comprehensible only to those who are prepared both morally and spiritually. So bees came to me as allies. I have a soft spot for butterflies, and butterflies universally are an image of the soul. In fact, the Greek word psyche means both soul and butterfly. So butterflies are certainly allies. And what an interesting image in our dreams, the image of the butterfly. It's a caterpillar. It looks like a lowly worm, this lowly thing. Goes into a cocoon, shuts itself off from the outside world, and emerges on shining wings. This, in dream after dream after dream of contemporary dreamers, is a wonderful, beautiful, empowering, uplifting image of how the soul spreads its wings, perhaps after a time of incubation and isolation, going into yourself, into the cocoon, and emerging. Snakes. We could do a whole dissertation on snakes. many of us in Western traditions are a little bit uneasy about snakes, particularly if we live in rattlesnake country or live in a country full of venomous snakes, as I did in Australia, where white people tend to kill snakes on sight, frankly, because there are so many poisonous snakes that you run into. Yet the snake in dreams, if we overcome our initial terror or fear or misgivings, is often a consummate image of healing and transformation. Think of Asclepius, the Greek personification of healing, above all of the healing that comes through sacred sleep, through special dreams. Asclepios is escorted by his snake mascots. He is shown in sculpture and in bas-relief with a snake coiled around his arm. In his abaton, in his sacred dormitory where you go in hopes of the gift of a dream healing, you will be fortunate, perhaps, to have his yellowish-white mascot snakes slither over you during the night. One of his snakes might actually come to you and by touching you, even by biting you, bring you the healing in that moment of sacred sleep. So what are snakes? Dream on it. What is the dragon? Dream on the dragon. By this point, you may have a number of questions about this theme of your relationship with animal guardians who appear in dreams. Is there a universal symbology involved here? Does the snake or the wolf or the tiger mean the same thing cross-culturally? Can you go and look it up in a dictionary of zoology or mythology or symbology and get a reliable reading? Well, there are themes and characteristics that resonate. And certainly if you find in your dreams or in your waking life that you're in touch and feel closely related to a particular animal, you should study its habits and its natural environment. If you're connected with the beaver, perhaps you have an ability to swim underwater. Perhaps you are a busy beaver who works hard and can build your lodge and build your dam and so on. So you can discover some things from observing the natural behavior of the bird or animal that you feel connected to. And in the process, you may discover something about yourself and something that echoes and resonates cross-culturally. In terms of the symbolic associations attached to different animal or bird or reptilian entities, this is often culture-specific. Snakes are revered or demonized in different cultures. Go amongst Iroquois Indians and you go amongst the people who kill snakes on sight. There are Native Americans for whom the snake is a great medicine power, but that's not so amongst some of the woodland tribes of the Northeast, partly perhaps because their territory was once infested by rattlesnakes. What is the dragon? Well, it depends whose dragon it is. Your dragon might be Puff the Magic Dragon. It might be a fire-breathing dragon who personifies your smoking addiction and your need to do something about it. It might be a cute heraldic dragon out of a beloved folk story or tales of King Arthur or the Pendragons. It might be a primal energy of earth or one of the elements. The dragon is, perhaps, the greatest, most powerful personification of the elemental energies of earth itself. That is an awesome force. If you're dealing with the dragon in that way, you have a challenge and an opportunity that is quite immense. So we can't really fall into setting one set of definitions or associations on these things. We have to dream on it. We have to be alive to the individuality and the individual authenticity of our experience. So if your dream companion is the dragon or the panther, or the bobcat, dream on it again. And that's the way you might discover whether this is truly, in the shamanic sense, a power animal, as opposed to a representation of some aspect of yourself that really doesn't go beyond representing that to you and reminding you of it. If you are dealing with a power animal in the shamanic sense, you'll be able to invoke it and work with it. You'll be able to test your relationship by calling on its support and its strength in different modes of your life. You will find yourself needing to feed it. You might find yourself having to change your diet or exercise patterns in some ways if this relationship becomes clear to you. So how do you enter into this relationship in the first place? The best way, once again, is through the gateway of your own spontaneous dream experiences. The Australian Aborigines have a saying that the big stories, the great stories, are forever hunting their tellers as predatory animals stalk and sniff and track their quarry in the bush. They jump on the person who is the right one to tell them. Well, our spiritual allies stalk us in our dreams, as the raven shaman stalked that woman dreamer into her sewing room, as the Bengal tiger stalked and then captured and then directed that male dreamer into discovering his own ability to fly. Perhaps your power animal, or a bird that symbolizes your ability to fly and see at great distances, is hunting you already through your dreams. Catch your dreams, look at them in this light, and then practice again the technique of going back inside your dream to explore your deeper possible relationship with this dream ally. If you want a simple technique to use, try this one. Get yourself again in a quiet and protected space. Use breathing to get yourself relaxed and shift your attention. Follow the flow of your breathing for a while. And be careful to put away from you any distractions, any negative thoughts or feelings. You are sitting or lying with your eyes closed in a fully protected space, a safe space. And you are going to allow yourself to flow in your awareness back to that tree you discovered, back to your special tree. You are going to use your tree gate as your place of rendezvous with an animal helper or a bird ally that might reveal itself to you. Simply let your consciousness flow back to the tree that you found and see which way you are drawn. Perhaps your ally is waiting for you at the tree. If your ally is not waiting for you at the tree, see whether you are drawn upwards or downwards. There's no moral distinction here. It's a question of your present gravitation. You might feel yourself drawn downwards into the earth. You might see yourself then traveling down through the roots of the tree, or down through a hole in the ground, through a passage, a tunnel-like passage, at the end of which you will come out in a different landscape to find, perhaps, an animal ally waiting for you. You might find a variety of animals in this landscape. See which one you are drawn to. See whether it has something to communicate with you. See whether it wishes to lead you in a certain direction. And go with the flow of that experience. You are free to ask any questions you may have. You are free to see whether there is some gift that this ally may have for you to bring back with you. And you will take whatever time you need to pursue this encounter. And you will understand that if the encounter is real and vivid to you, this is a place you may return to again for further communication. Alternatively, shifting awareness back to the tree itself and the place where the tree stands, you may feel your gravitation is different. You may feel yourself drawn upward, in which case you might find yourself encountering a bird or a whole flock of birds that are somehow connected with you and being invited to travel with them, being invited to fly. If that is the way you are drawn, you should flow with that. There are different times for different things, and it is very important for you to identify the right timing and the right gateway for your own experiences, which is why again and again throughout these sessions I am going to insist on your need to work with your own spontaneous and individual experiences and imagery. On care and feeding of your animal allies, study the animal you are connected to. Study its habits. See what you can learn about yourself, for good and bad, about those habits. I mean, a mouse or a rabbit is not usually regarded by most Westerners as being powerful medicine, but a mouse or a rabbit has its own teaching, doesn't it? They're both animals that know how to hide. They have many other gifts. So study the habits and characteristics of your animal and see what you can borrow from it and what you perhaps might need to correct in yourself. If you're connected with the tiger, you don't necessarily want to be going all over your environment ripping throats out, do you? I hope not. You might find that you need gentle. The aspect of your energy, which comes to you in the form of a large predator, you might feel that you need to brave up in some ways. Part of your energy that comes to you as a rabbit. If this connection is to be real and vital in your life, you need to find ways to honor it. You're probably going to want to wear something that represents that animal. You might wish to make yourself a personal talisman that represents that animal. How do you work with it on a daily basis? Well, let's take the theme of courage. It's particularly applicable to women in our society who are so often abused, oppressed, repressed, put upon. You found your connection with your panther, or your wolf, or your fox. Walk it, live it, skillfully. Feel yourself walking with that animal at times of challenge or stress. It will make an automatic difference in the way you go about in this world. It will make a difference in your energy field, which can actually be perceived with clairvoyant sight. It will make a difference in the way that people react to you. If you're walking with your wolf or your panther, this is practical advice, I believe. I think you will find that people are no longer so readily inclined to take advantage of you or to push you around. When it comes to healing, many of our power animal relationships bring gifts of healing for ourselves or others. Reclaiming this relationship is often reclaiming, literally, a part of our own energy that went missing at some point in our lives. Some of the animals have a special function in healing. I remember, as a personal story, an extraordinary event up on a magic mountain in the northeast of North America. When the stag came through for the benefit of the group, an immense elk seemed to walk into the middle of the circle and seemed to direct us in the midst of a spontaneous healing circle as we tried to assist a woman whose physical problem had been diagnosed as a disease of the autoimmune system. In other words, her body's T cells and suppressors and killers were attacking her own body system, having ceased to be able to recognize what belonged in her body and what did not. Her disease had been prescribed as MS, a typical and often life-threatening and horrific challenge to the autoimmune system. It was very interesting to watch in that workshop what became available beyond the comprehension of any of us, including myself. Once the primal spirit of the deer, the elk, the stag, came through on the mountaintop, it seemed channeled through one of us. It seemed to open the woman's head and show beneath layer after layer of tissue what needed to be put right, and it seemed to work through laser-like beams of energy projected through the horns of the antlers of the stag in a quite specific way, escaping rational description or analysis, to work inside her body system. I was awed by what came through. I went outside into the night air, wondering whether what we had all believed to have happened would actually be manifested in the woman's later life, or whether it would prove to be some cruel deception. And a woman who lived near the mountain came out to talk to me. She said, "Robert, I must tell you about the deer of this mountain, the stag of the mountain. Hunters have been talking about this stag for years. He has an immense rack of horns, like the antlers of the deer or elk I had seen in my vision. I called him an elk from time to time because of his size. I think his antlers were actually those of a deer, but he was larger than any deer I have ever seen or had ever dreamed before. I must tell you the story of the stag of this mountain," she says. "He's out here somewhere, the hunters say. They've all been eager to get his rack and put it on their wall. And the story has been repeated 3 times now. We've all heard it around here. But a moment has come when a hunter has stood eye to eye, face to face with the stag of this mountain, and looking into those calm eyes. The hunter, one, two, three of them, have put down their guns, refused the killing shot, given up killing, and never hunted again. This, it turned out, is a legend of this mountain in upstate New York, that there is a stag who lives there, who has actually deterred three hunters who have talked, gasping about their experiences in local coffee shops or bars, deterred them from killing, and persuaded them to give up hunting. Think of that in relation to a disease of the autoimmune system in which the need is to learn somehow, to find some means to train the body's own systems to stop killing its own cells, its own tissues, the myelin sheath in this case. The woman seemed to be in remission after these experiences. We don't know whether that is going to hold good for the rest of her life. We're all born to die. And healing is not necessarily about dealing with physical symptoms. From a shamanic point of view, it's not primarily about dealing with symptoms anyway. It's about doing work on the level of soul, so no guarantees or undertakings about that sort of thing. But I learnt from that experience, which, as you can hear from my voice, still leaves me awed and humbled every time it returns to me. I learned something about the larger aspect of the healing energy involved in our conscious work with spiritual allies who might present themselves in the form of animal guardians. I learned something quite specifically about the power of healing that seemed to flow from the deer on that mountain, and was confirmed and validated not only by changes in a person who was present in a healing circle, but by the story, the legend of the mountain, told by the hunters who put down their guns when they looked into the eyes of the stag who taught them to give up predatory killing. So we've learnt some essential aspects of the shaman's way of dreaming, particularly the shamanic relationship with an ally who appears in the form of a bird or animal. We are now ready to look at other ways of dreaming that are the particular province of shamanic types, not just people who call themselves shamanic practitioners or tribal practitioners in a traditional environment, but those of us who seem to dream in the manner of shamans and wish to pursue that adventure to deeper levels.